Hello, this is Roger Molina on Creative Disturbance. I'm delighted today to be a longtime friend and colleague, Lucy H.G. Solomon. Lucy, you're from a strange organization called the League of Imaginary Scientists.
That's true.
What is this group and what do they do? And tell us about yourself.
We are a group of artists and tinkerers who bring in scientists. We are science-minded and we collaborate with scientists.
And you've worked on a number of interesting projects over the years. I originally met you in connection with a project in Ireland called Lovely Weather, which was being run by the Donegal Center.
Is that That's right.
And Leonardo.
Yeah. And I'd met you before that at
Metamorphosis in Prague.
And in the E-Mobile project.
Yes, that's right. So for some reason we're on the same song line.
I think the art side connection.
And you're here doing some investigative reporting, which we're not going to talk about, but you're trying to set up an art science initiative in your own university.
This is true.
Which university is that?
That's Cal State San Marcos.
Okay. And so, indeed, what's interesting is many places are now trying to figure out how to create these incubators for art science work. But let's just first come back to the Irish project. So tell us about why you convinced a small fishing community in Ireland to study the surface of Mars.
I think the starting point was convincing NASA, a huge organization, to work with a small, relatively odd arts organization like us. So getting an entryway into the Mars Exploration Rover team was crucial. And getting the enthusiasm of Steve Squires, who is the head of the project, and really generous with his time, because he would email us responses so quickly that I just thought, wow, this is in a queue behind really essential planet study, and he's focusing on this multicultural and collaborative arts project.
So he was leading one of the teams that sent rover robots to the surface of Mars.
He's the head of the whole MERS project.
MERS project, and the initiative you were working on in Ireland was this Lovely Weather project about art and climate change. So how
do we make that connection?
How do you make that connection?
We had an entry, which was. Happens to be that one of our league collaborators, and this is how our projects organically evolve, one of our league collaborators' brothers is a geophysicist who worked with NASA on the project. So we did have an entryway, and through that entryway we thought, how can we connect Mars to planet Earth, and not just planet Earth, but a unique spot in Northwest Ireland, where our funding and the source of this project was. So we asked through a poll via radio, because the small populations, the concentrated areas of in Northwest Ireland, still at least 5 years ago, still communicated and learned a lot of their news via radio.
Via radio.
Versus the internet. So they had these polls on the radio that we had initiated asking, where should we locate Mars on Earth, and specifically in Northwest Donegal? The overarching principle was that we were going to twin a location, and that's how the Irish refer to what in the US we might call sister cities.
Sister cities, yeah.
So they wanted to twin a location on Mars with someplace on Earth. And this started two trajectories. One was finding the place in Ireland. The other was finding the location on Mars. And at the time, the only surviving Mars rover, because one had become decapacitated, the only one that was still functioning was in a vast desert. And so while we found a place on Ireland, which was called Illarua, which in Gaelic means the Red Island, there was a local councilman who nominated Illarua as our site for study.
So there was a symbolic connection through the name.
Yes, and this was a tiny island that it had a causeway that connected to it occasionally. That when the tides came up, it became an island, and when the tides went down, you could approach the island by vehicle. So when we went there, I believe there were 11 people who lived in this small area, who most of whom were family, and we were welcomed into this family. They put us up in their houses.
So did you build a robot? Did you study the aliens?
We were the Mars robot. We were the robots ourselves, and we replicated both the studies of the surface of Earth in the ocean and in the Earth to look at what the Mars rovers were doing with the aerographic features of Mars. We were looking at the geographic features of Earth, comparing those with this underlying question, which was really the reverse timeline of Mars. If the Mars rovers team, if NASA is out there on Mars asking this big question, did Mars once look anything like Earth? 4 billion years ago, did they have water? Did the planet have water? I'm already positing Martians. But we were asking the reverse. In 4 billion years, will Earth look like Mars? Will our oxygen-rich atmosphere become depleted in a way that will replicate that of Mars? And are we on that forward trajectory, just like we think Mars has a past trajectory that may replicate or resemble Earth?
So I guess embedded that is the idea that the climate change takes place on all planets, not just our own planet. And obviously the Martian climate has changed dramatically over the last billion years. And so I guess for the community you were working with in Ireland, this was probably a rather abstract framework. So how did you bring it home?
Strangely, they were delighted. We hit the news. Uh-huh. When we got there, the newspapers announced the Martians have arrived. And the locals
you were, and Orson Welles.
Yeah. There was this fun, almost a 1950s feeling of we've brought the future in this past participle kind of way. We were time traveling. It was quite an adventure.
Okay, so let me just do a little jump in our conversation. So indeed, you know, one of the embedded ideas there is that climate change is happening so slowly that we don't detect it as human beings, and many of the warnings of climate change are come to us through data that we don't actually have senses for. And so one of the things that you've been interested in is the whole issue of data literacy, and how, in my vocabulary, I think I told you yesterday, that we're still in the stone age of the data culture, and we're still using, you know, pens and pencils, and nobody's invented the disruptive technology for data. So where does your interest in data come from? And talk about that a little bit more.
So our collective, the League of Imaginary Scientists, our stance on this is through the lens of evolution. And if we look at the senses, the human senses, we have a sense for most information that's perceptible.
And so, in fact, more than that, through human evolution, our senses have been tuned to the particular environment we're living in, right? Mm. So, given that we have sunlight that's in a particular color of light, why the hell would we have eyes that detect X-rays? Because
right.
None of the solar X-rays reach the surface of the Earth, and it wouldn't help you survive on Earth to have X-ray eyes.
Right.
So our senses are very adaptive.
Why did the Inuit have, I don't know, 15 words
for snow?
White? Right. Yeah, same.
And idea. So, this data literacy you're talking about is probably a survival skill.
Mm-hmm. Yes, and how do we evolve that human sense to perceive this new ecological system of data that expresses our environment in a way that we need to see it? We need to survive in a changing planet. We need to perceive those changes.
And we need to understand cause and effect in the same way that we know that when the sun comes up, the ice melts, and we have cause and effect between two things. For climate change, it's very difficult for us to see the cause and effect of our own actions.
One thing we've played with is this, the personification of data. So in that sense, we have one project that's a collaboration with a group of Danish choreographers and a chemist, a US-based chemist and composer, and an architect in our league came together to think about water. We did a project in many shapes and forms, and one of the offshoots of this project was a performance of a human glacier, which I think most accurately depicts how we feel about these huge events in planetary scales that we can't relate to. So this is a very extremely slow-moving dance of quite literally a mass of people melting, and I say melting in quotes, to become the melted glaciers.
And so, I mean, clearly, you know, watching those dancers, and you showed us a video, it immediately puts people in a very different time frame, right? They know that change is very slow.
Right. One could walk around this mass of dancers and not see
any movement.
Right.
But if you came back an hour later,
there's a perceptible change.
And so this idea of imperceptible change, I guess, came across through that dance performance.
And this was a fun project in other ways, in that it required a sharing of processes among different disciplines engaged in it.
We have a few minutes left. I thought you might tell us about another project you're heavily involved in, which is about jaguars.
Ah, yes. So this is a project in its infancy. There are two researchers at the Institute for Conservation Research in San Diego, and
keep going.
One of those researchers is Samia Carrillo-Pastegaway, and the other is Matthias Tobler. They're jaguar experts, which already is cool enough for me to want to collaborate with them. But their main interest is in stopping the slow encroachment by humans on the jaguar habitat in the jungles of Peru. They have collected a mass of data, and so this collaboration, really, the crux of it is thinking about how to communicate that data in a visceral, interactive way that also makes humans feel part of that ecosystem that the jaguars are so essentially a part of. People have the misperception in this area, as in where I live, in San Marcos, in Escondido, California, that the wildcats are really in conflict with humanity. So we don't grow the skills to live alongside these creatures.
Yeah, your mention of the term human encroachment just reminds me, and I haven't read the book yet, but E.O. Wilson, the biologist, has a new book out where he advocates actually dedicating large fractions of the planet to human-free zones.
Right, 50%, I think.
I forgot the number. And part of his argument is that conservation techniques, in fact, probably are doomed to failure, because what you need to conserve is this amazingly complicated balance that an ecosystem reflects, and preserving the jaguars without preserving all these other species at the same time and so on.
The forest itself, and so on.
And so apparently he's been quite negative on conservation efforts, because he thinks that for human beings to stay in balance with the ecosystem, we really need to have 50% of the planet where there is no human encroachment. Mm-hmm. And obviously that's a slightly radical idea, but I think it does get the point across that, as you say, in this case, we have all the data, and how to understand the impact of what we do in the local environment is very difficult for us to understand, and it's not enough to save the penguins.
That's true. Changing our behavior, changing how we perceive the planet is one step. My 5-year-old daughter asked me a couple days ago, how long is a day on the sun? Such a fun conceptual question.
It does have an answer, because the sun does rotate on its own axis.
All right.
On the other hand, and I guess, you know, from the sun's point of view, I mean, it's always daylight. But
and that's what's beautiful, is that she takes the sun's point of view.
Yeah. Okay, well, maybe on that note, let's take the sun's point of view. And thank you, Lucy, for this chat.
Thank you. I've enjoyed talking with you.
Okay, very good. And we'll meet you again on the song line.
Lovely.
I